We left off our friend Noah and his family coming out of the ark, trying to get things established. And in chapters 10 and 11 of Genesis, we find out what happened. So let me pick up at chapter 10. We're only going to read some pieces of it. Remember, actually, this would be a good question for the kids. Kids haven't had a question for a while. All right, here's a question for the kids. Okay, there's Noah had three sons. In fact, they had a television show after him. Your parents probably remember that. Excuse me. Have to think about that. Now, Noah had three sons, and I'd like the name. Give me the name of one of the sons. Yes. Shem, there's one. Who's got another one? All right, Ryan. Ham, now here's the tough one. Sharon? Japheth, all right. Hey, these kids are all right. Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Interesting names. We talked about the one that I'm the most amused by, of course, is the name Shem, and we've talked about that before, because it means name, right? It's kind of a funny. They obviously were at a loss. So, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Interesting names, and they became really the progenitors of everyone, as far as, again, depending on how you see things. But for the, you know, the tradition, common tradition, is that they, in Christianity, is that they were the progenitors of everyone, and that there's some evidence for this, by the way. I mean, it's not just some harebrained idea or some mythological story here, because the evidence is quite strong. It turns out that Shem, in fact, the name people talk about three races, actually. I don't know what modern anthropology does with the whole concept. I haven't read up on it recently. I probably should have. But again, traditional thought is that there were three races, each one coming from these people. And of course, one of them is the Semitic race. Semitic would be the descendants of Shem, and then there's Hamitic, and I don't know what to do about Japhethitic, but that's a little pathetic. But the sorry about that. But Shem, the Semites tended to move east. Actually, they didn't move. Almost everybody tended to kind of hang out. The family tended to hang out a few hundred miles south of where the ark had rested, into what seems to be, as far as we can locate these places, seems to be right around Babylon, and we're going to read about that. It was in the plain of Shinar, which is a very fertile plain over there, not far from the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, right between those and in what is today known as the Fertile Crescent. The Semites tended to stay there. The descendants of Japheth tended to move north up into the Caucasus Mountains. And actually, that's where we get the Caucasians. Caucasians were descendants from Japheth, who had moved north, and probably up through Russia and then eastward to Europe. The Hamitic people, or Ham and his family, tended to settle everywhere. I mean, they were really quite powerful, as we'll read here, and. One of his sons is Canaan, and he settled that whole Canaanite valley, which ultimately God gave to descendants of Shem, which is kind of an interesting point. He gave it to Abraham, and he had to kick all the Canaanites out of there. But then they also settled down into East Africa, Egypt, and all of this. Now, we just touched briefly last week on the fact that Ham had done something, Ham had done something that wasn't very smart when his father was drunk and ended up being punished for it. When his descendants ended up moving down into Africa, one of the things that we real bright Caucasians thought we could do to justify slavery was to say, oh, well, these are descendants of Ham, and Ham had committed a sin, and was cursed with being in a role of servitude to the other tribes, and therefore it's okay for us to hold slaves. That was one of the arguments used back there in the slavery days, and it was a pitiful argument. I mean, it's still talking about ignorance, but some of the other arguments, of course, were that some people said, well, gee, our black brethren you know, aren't really as sophisticated. They're really part of the animal kingdom as opposed to man's kingdom. They really believe this. I mean, just, I mean, we're talking about total absurdity and talking about justification of evil. So there's a couple different things that happen. Well, the descendants of Ham probably did populate Africa. Descendants of Shem stayed kind of there in the Middle East, and the Arabs and Jews are both part of that whole region. Japheth up in the Caucasus Mountains and northward. And the question comes up, well, what about the Asians? You know, Oriental, the whole Oriental people who even have significant differences in appearance. And I don't know what the explanation is for that, so I can't answer that one. It may have been some sort of a union between descendants of Japheth and descendants of Shem that ended up you know, there in the east. Again, I don't really know what the origins. I'm sure there's theories on it, I just don't know enough to tell you about them. Okay, but anyway, so we have this. We have the people, them spreading through the area. And let me just pick up a couple of verses here. Verse 1 of chapter 10, it says, now there are the records of the generations of Shem, Ham, and Japheth, the sons of Noah. The sons were born to them after the flood. Well, that's what we're talking about. And we get the names of some of them. The sons of Japheth were Gomer and Magog and Madai, Javan, Tubal, Meshech, and Tiras. And now later on, the only reason I read that is because you'll hear in the book of Ezekiel, there's a very strange prophecy that talks about Tubal and Meshech. And people have kind of wondered about that a long time. You know, what Meshech? That kind of sounds like Moscow. And a lot of people in the during the era of communism, and particularly Russian communism, you know, we're taking that verse in Ezekiel, as saying, oh, wait a minute, he's talking about Rosh also, by the way, Rosh and Meshech. And they say, Rosh, that's Russia, and Meshech, that sounds like Moscow. And so Rosh and Meshech, he's obviously talking about something that's going to happen when Russia and communism comes and tries to attack the Middle East. And that's apparently proven to be, it certainly seems like that's not the way it's happening. Well, you don't have to go that far. The fact is that Meshech and Tubal are names of descendants of Japheth. And it could have meant a lot of different things, but it didn't have to be Moscow, you know. But anyway, that's for those of you who care about that particular subject. But anyway, unfortunately, most of us don't have to anymore. And then he goes on and tells us about Gomer and his descendants, Ashkenaz and Rephath and Togarmah. And he goes on, gives the different names. You can read them yourselves if you have a lot of patience. And it says here in verse 5, from these, the coastlands of the nations were separated into their lands, everyone according to his language, according to their families, into their nations. Well, he's talking about the separation now. Well, we're going to read about the separation. Separation hadn't happened yet, in detail. In chapter 11, he's going to talk about how the separation happened, how people actually did start moving out. Because the fact was that they were all in one place. And they're telling us, so he's kind of doing a flash forward here for a while in chapter 10. Telling us about what's going to happen, or what's happening kind of in a global sense. But then we're going to go in chapter 11 and kind of take a few steps back and see how it happened. Okay, but before we get there, we need to understand a couple other things. In verse 6, he talks about Ham. So the sons of Ham were Cush, Mizraim, Put, and Canaan. We mentioned Canaan before. The sons of Cush were Sheba, Havilah, Sabta, Ra'ama, Sabteka, and the sons of Ra'ama were Sheba and Dedan. Okay, they keep going on and on. But listen to this, verse 8. And now Cush, and some of you kids will get a kick out of this because it's kind of a modern word today. Now Cush became the father of Nimrod. All right, now Nimrod, I don't know, you kids use that name today still? No? Some people call him Nimrod. Yeah, that's kind of a thing. My kids started using it, calling each other Nimrod, you know. I mean, it sounds like a great name. But it turns out Nimrod was actually quite a magnificent leader. He says he became a mighty one on the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore, it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord. There are some of the archaeological excavations have uncovered this warrior figure who was conquering a lion. And it was believed that the name is quite similar to the name that we have here in Hebrew as Nimrod. And they think that probably is who he was. But this guy was apparently quite skilled, was able to take care of the wild animals, who were a real problem. Remember, we read about that after they all came out of the ark, God said, I got some bad news for you. He didn't say it quite this way, but, you know, it's a little bit of a paraphrase. I got some bad news for you. That is, you're going to be killing each other. And not only that, but the animals are going to kill you too. Now, you know, I'm not sure why. No wonder Noah drank. But the fact is that the animals, I mean, were a real problem, right? I mean, lions were a little more skilled at devouring humans than humans were of lions at that time. And before the shotgun. So it was, you know, there's a real problem. Well, that's why Nimrod, I mean, there's a guy who was okay. He could handle those animals, not a problem to him. And he became very well respected. It says in verse 10, and the beginning of his kingdom was Babel. And Erech, and Akkad, and Calna in the land of Shinar. And from that land he went forth into Assyria, and he built Nineveh, and Rehoboth-ir and Calah. And then it starts talking about more of the cities and more of these descendants and all. Well, this Nimrod guy was apparently the first to be an organizer there after the flood. This guy had the kind of leadership skills that drew people to him, and he started building. And we're going to see some of the things that apparently he was responsible for building. Okay, so then he goes on and talks about various things, and then he gets down in verse 21, the descendants of Shem. And it goes through the list, and we'll come back to that list actually in chapter 12, or at the end actually of chapter 11, so we won't spend a lot of time on it right now. Again, verse 31, these are the sons of Shem, this is after he's told the whole list. These are the sons of Shem, according to their families, according to their languages, by their lands, according to their nations. In verse 32, these are the families of the sons of Noah, according to their genealogies, by their nations. And out of these, the nations were separated on the earth after the flood. Again, they're talking about languages, different languages. But that's kind of looking forward. So we got to step back, because they all spoke the same language at first. I mean, you know, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and Noah on the ark all spoke the same language. It was this thing. I don't know how they talked to the animals, but that's a whole other thing. And we know that from verse 1 of chapter 11. Now the whole earth, or again, it could be the whole land, used the same language and the same words. Actually, kind of funny, the Hebrew word here is lip. They all had the same lip. Now, it's no wonder they didn't travel very far. No. Sorry. Have to think about that one. The lip apparently does mean language. It's also kind of funny because safah is a Hebrew word for lip. Now, safah, which is very similar, almost exactly the same word, letters, is another word, and it looks almost identical. In fact, the last letter, which is kind of the H sound, is it's just this tiny little, almost microscopic extension of one of the strokes of the pen turns that into a different letter. There's a he and a he. And just a little stroke of the pen changes that. And so you got safa and safak. Well, safak means bald, everybody being bald. And I was hoping that it was, anyway, but that was probably before the fall. Anyway, and it came about as they journeyed east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they settled there. So this is Noah and his family. So we've gone backward. Noah and his family, they settled in the plain of Shinar. They said to one another, "Come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly." And they used brick for stone, and they used tar for mortar. And they said, "Come, let us build for ourselves a city and a tower whose top will reach into heaven, and let us make for ourselves a name, lest we be scattered abroad." Now listen to their purpose. This is what they had intended. "Lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth." Okay, so they figured out how to build. They knew that there probably was a lot of technology that they brought with them and from before the flood days. In that land area, there was apparently a lot of tar, probably related to somehow the petroleum that was way down under the earth anyway. There was a lot of tar. There were tar pits. There were ways that there's also a lot of mud there. It's not real clear what this Hebrew word was referring to, whether it was referring to mud or whether it was referring to tar, whatever it was. They had mortar. They could make bricks. They could make mortar. They could build. And they knew how to build. And they decided to build. And chances are, it's under this fellow Nimrod's leadership that this is all taking place. Again, there's a lot of archaeological evidence for that. And it's apparently around Babylon. So they start building this tower. And the purpose for building this tower, as they say, is that let's make for ourselves a name lest we be scattered abroad. In other words, let's make for ourselves some sort of unity, some sort of uniting force. One thing about a tower, remember, they didn't have Thomas Brothers at that time. They didn't have, you know, the kind of maps that we have today, right? They didn't have compasses. When they're going to go somewhere, they have to figure out how to navigate and get places properly. And they're just learning how to handle. These people are smart. They're not even no dummies at all. They were able to figure out things pretty well. But it's a lot easier to figure out where the city is in the middle of kind of wilderness area if you've got a big tower that you can see, right? And this is why, back in the east, east coast and in many places, they build a tall steeple, right, on your church. Why? So you can see it from anywhere and you know where to go. I mean, it's just easy. You follow your nose, you find this, and you know where the church is, and that's where you go. Well, they would build these, so they decide they're going to build a tower. Well, God doesn't like that. That's kind of interesting. You say, well, why wouldn't he like that? Well, let's find out. The Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. And the Lord said, "Behold, they are one people, and they all have the same lip." Language. "And this is what they began to do, and now nothing which they purpose to do will be impossible for them. Come, let us go down." He uses us there again. God and, I guess, his heavenly hosts, or God in his multiplicity. Not multiple gods, but multifacets. And there confuse their language. And this is what they will be, what they began to do. Oh, excuse me. That they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of the whole earth, and they stopped building the city. Therefore its name was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of the whole earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of the whole earth. The Tower of Babel. We've heard this story before. There's a lot of things that have been added to it, and you read some of the Bible story books and you see all kinds of stuff, and a lot of things have been kind of added to the image of what was going on. Some people have said, well, they were building. When I was a kid and going to Sunday school and all, I mean, I grew up thinking that this was an observatory because that's what everybody was saying it was supposed to be, you know, that it was, that it was an observatory for worshiping the stars, and that's why God destroyed them. Well, those were attempts of people trying to explain it. And that's okay, and maybe it was something like that. But we're going to stick with what the Scripture says, because otherwise we'll, you know, be in jeopardy of adding things to the story. So we need to understand what the Scripture is saying here. Well, clearly we know what happened. God didn't like this tower. The question comes as to why. Well, he says why, actually. He says that, he says two things that he's concerned about. He says they all have the same language, and that was okay. This is what they've begun to do. In other words, the fact that they all can communicate effectively, here's what the next step was for them, and God was concerned about that. And the second thing, he says, nothing which they purpose to do will be impossible for them. In other words, they're going to be able to do some stuff. And you say, well, why would God be concerned about that? Well, it's probably good for us to look back and see what God told them to do. Because that's a good thing. What did God instruct them to do? And if we understand what God instructed them to do, then maybe we can see where they went awry. Well, if we go back to chapter 10, or 9, actually, verse 7, as for you, is God speaking to Noah, be fruitful and multiply, populate the earth abundantly and multiply in it. The Hebrew actually says, fill the earth. Well, they weren't doing that. They were all in this area. They were building up their metropolis. And they weren't filling the earth. God wanted them to fill the earth. That's what he told them to do. Now, I don't know why he wanted them to fill the earth, but I have some ideas on it. But I suspect that the fact is they weren't doing what God said to do. He wanted them to fill the earth. And instead, they were centralizing. They were becoming this great city. They were building. They were doing all this stuff. And God said, whoa, this isn't what I intended. Now, just a couple suspicions, and this is just speculative, but the fact is that the cities, when people group together in cities throughout history, ultimately those civilizations, if you want to call them that, disappeared. Ultimately, they self-destructed. Because that's the way man does things. Without God in the act, without God in the center of what is going on, we human beings find a way to self-destruct. We do it. And we continue to do it. And we will continue to do it. We find a way to self-destruct. Most of the civilizations that were around back at that time self-destructed. Many of them, we don't even know why. In fact, we go through and try to find the roots. Some of the mysteries of history are what happened to this particular people? Why did they all die out? What about this one? What about that one? Well, today we have a better clue about it, because we understand a little bit more about infectious diseases. We understand a little bit more about sexually transmitted diseases. We understand a little bit more about a lot of different things like that, and it's not that hard for us to see why a people could totally destroy themselves. They wouldn't listen. They'd stop listening to God, stop following what God had established as the order of things for life, and would start adopting practices that would lead to other practices, which would lead to other practices, which ultimately would be so far away from what God intended for man that the civilization would self-destruct. Well, that happened. I suspect that that's the reason that God had the Israelites destroy every man, woman, and child in some of the cities that they conquered, because of some sort of infectious diseases or something like that, that were, as heinous a crime as that sounds like, the threat of destroying God's people through whom he would ultimately bring the Messiah was too great a threat that he couldn't take the risk. And he had to instruct them to wipe it out and burn it because of the evil prime. Again, and the archaeological evidence, again, is pretty clear. The evil was just so, so profound that it's not hard to imagine that would be a situation. Well, God didn't want them all congregated in one place, possibly because of that, because they weren't going to survive if they did that. What he needed is an earth that had enough critical mass of people that they could survive. And so he wanted them out separated. And the only way that he, a good way for him to do that was to do this. Alright? You guys aren't going to separate? I'll teach you how to separate. You're going to have different languages. And they had different languages. And I tell you, we have enough of a challenge here in most of us in Southern California. Run into this all the time. I run into it in my workplace. We got, every language practically on the face of the earth, in our group. And, and even people who do speak English and have learned English. I work with a whole slew of people with PhD degrees that they've earned in America and yet still have a fairly, fairly strong accents, or still have relatively limited communication skills in English, and they're brilliant people. And it's tough. It's tough when you're trying to do something complicated and got to talk to each other. And you've got a simple task, and you can do it. You do hand motions and stuff. But you get something that's complicated, and it's pretty tough to do. And you find a way to do it. But it's difficult. Well, if you didn't have at least English as a common thread, it'd be impossible to do some of the things that at least that we have to do in our organization. We have we're building an instrument that sits it's probably about this tall, about the same width as the table. It has 30 computers in it, separate computers. It's got 30-some motors, 100-some switches inside. It's 3,000 parts. There's a lot of things to it, and creating something like that, getting that built, isn't easy. I mean, it's a real pain to get it done. In fact, you think about God says, well, nothing will be impossible for them if they have these communication skills that they had. Well, I wish we had the communication skills today, because I'll tell you, to build even some little box like we're trying to build, which is not like a tower of, that clearly was organizing thousands of people, or however many there were, maybe at least hundreds of people to do the job. Getting people organized is not easy. Getting people all to do the same thing is not easy. It's a constant reminder to me at how much greater God is than we are. Because we build, even we human beings, we say today, well, gee, well, look at these big skyscrapers downtown, and they are great. And look at some of the technology. This instrument that we're building is really a high-tech instrument. It's kind of impressive in some ways. But it's not that impressive when you think the complexity of what we're building is just infinitesimal compared to the human body, for example, which God just created with a word. God just creates something with a word. It takes us, 140 people, 5 years of mistakes that we're trying to correct to get something built that at least we think we're sort of impressed with. And God looks at that and says, gee, that's a nice ox cart, How come it took you so long to do it? Well, the fact is that God chose for this not to be the focus of man's existence. It's not the focus of man's existence. He was not going to let them do that. That wasn't what he intended. He had bigger things in mind. He spread them. He wanted them spread throughout that world, and by golly, they were going to get spread throughout that world. And he made it happen. God has done similar things many times in history. He certainly did that, the same thing, to the apostolic church. The apostles were together. The church was just thriving in Jerusalem, multiplying daily. The people were living in a communal lifestyle. It was just a going concern. I mean, it would talk about the mega church, you know. I mean, this was the first mega church. I mean, it was really there. And they were just, you know, they had to have parking lot attendance the whole bit, you know. I mean, it was really a big thing. And it wasn't too many years that God decided that, no, this isn't what I want here. And Herod killed James. And that seemed to be a good, this was a later Herod, it wasn't the same Herod that was around when Jesus was born. He saw that the Pharisees and the religious leaders, the political leaders in Judaism at the time liked that, and he was trying to get their favor and kind of get a good thing going so that the Roman Empire could continue to thrive in that area. And so he started persecuting the church wholly because in total, things started getting pretty wild. They also had stoned Stephen. That was the Jews themselves. There was a lot going on, and persecution started getting so intense that the church fragmented, and it just spread throughout the Mediterranean area. People just, they moved. They moved outside of Jerusalem. Well, it's clear that God intended that. It's clear that God, I mean, because nothing happens that God doesn't intend. I mean, God is the one. He's in control here. It's not, God's not sitting up there and saying, oh no, you know. I mean, He knows exactly what's going on. He knows what's going to go on. And nothing happens here that He doesn't permit. The gospel of Jesus Christ needed to get out. It needed to get to the struggling, lost people throughout the whole world. And He was going to make it happen. And He did. But He was going to make it happen in a way that man couldn't take credit for. And that's the other thing that God does, is He makes sure that He is the one who does it and no one else can take credit. God told Noah to go out, multiply, fill the earth. And Noah didn't do it. His descendants didn't do it. So God set up the situation, set up the conditions so they would do it. But they weren't going to be able to take credit. They couldn't strut around and say, look how great we are because look, we've followed God and we've done it so well that God has got to just think that we are the best people in the whole world. That's got to be it. I think that that is one of the great elements. One of the most, in fact, I'll call it one of the most mysterious and wonderful, in being, by that I mean full of wonder. The awesome elements, one of the awesome elements of what God does with us is He achieves His purposes in a balanced way. For example, we are chosen by God. We like to sometimes think we chose Him, but we didn't. He chose us. He reached out and grabbed us. He brought us, He grabbed us by the back of the shirt, picked us up, and made us look like we were standing on our feet, right? Look at the, closer to the picture, the toes aren't touching the ground, you know, but it looks like we're standing upright. He makes us a special people to whom He is rewarding eternal life. Eternal life. I mean, this is incredible. And He lets us know that those who are not responding to His call, however that is, are going to be eternally in trouble. And that's pretty awesome. That's pretty difficult to bear. And what that would do, what that should do for us, is make us feel pretty arrogant. Make us feel, hey, you know, I mean, look, we're certainly a lot better than these people. They're going to hell, I'm going to heaven. You know? But God, in His wondrous ways, has designed Christianity, designed the whole process of following Him as a process that we're only, quote, successful at it when we're being humbled, when we are being brought down to face to face with our inadequacies, face to face with our struggle, face to face with the difficulty of doing anything on our own by our own strength. He teaches us at the same time, through, I think, that the failure, the sense of failure that we all face throughout our lives, he also teaches us to love. So he teaches us to love. He teaches us that it's not our doing that has brought us to him. And so we have no choice but to care about the people that are lost. We can't be arrogant. Only God could invent something like this. Only he could do that. God accomplished his purpose with Noah and his offspring in a way that it's hard to understand. He is continuing to achieve his purposes with us in ways we don't understand. The same thing. Our job is to go with the flow, right? To go with God. He knows where he's taking us. I think this is very appropriate even for us here at the Harvester Mission. We don't know what God's going to do. We don't know where he's going to take us. I've encouraged different ones who have talked to me times to go, you know, who have said, "Gee, I want to, you know, want to consider another church or something." I've encouraged them to do that. Encouraged them. Why? Because it helps get the message, the liberating message that the New Testament gives us, and the Old Testament for that matter, the message that's there so clearly that we have had the privilege of being taught through what God did through my father and some of the others who have been influential here. There are many believers out there in churches who also need to know that. And those who have gone elsewhere, who we've had the privilege of ministering to or participating with, who now maybe in another church and are able to be a little foundation stone there, right? A little link to the real Jesus. And not caught up. You know, somebody who can say, "Well, wait a minute, there's another way here. You know, we don't have to get caught up in the thing, in the church scene, in the whole, you know, self-replicating, evolving process of religion. We can stay in tune with Jesus Christ himself in the midst." And I believe there's a lot of believers out there. It's not just people that have gone through the Harvester Mission. There's a lot of believers who understand that. There's an awful lot. God has put them here and there in the different churches. And in the churches, I think that there are some in each place that God has established as a sign to just kind of be there. Be there as a rock. Be there as a stake in the ground a stake that may kind of look like a cross in some ways, a stake in the ground that is holding steady to just who Jesus Christ is and to God's ability to get the job done without it depending on a whole bunch of frenetic human activities. God was not impressed with the Tower of Babel. Magnificent work. There's a big tower over there, some miles, I think about 10 miles from Babylon today, that some think may have been the ruins of the Tower of Babel that had been restored by someone a few hundred years later. And now, of course, there's ruins, but others have said, no, it probably was in the middle of Babylon. Who knows? The fact is, man has done a lot of things. God's not particularly impressed. What God's interested in is taking us his way. In our own lives, God's taking us his way. The way goes through all kinds of weird things. And maybe there's a lot of confused languages in the middle of it. And maybe we get confused. Like husbands and wives learning how to communicate, you know. I mean, talk about confused language, right? But God uses all of it to his purpose. He knows what he's doing.